You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. Talking about Shelby Miller and the developing pitchers in that Atlanta rotation, as well as Hector Oliveira, and new arrivals Michael Bourne and Nick Swisher when we talk Braves with Mark Bowman. Talking Marlins with Joe Fusaro, and talking a lot about the fences, as well as getting some injury updates. Talking Mets with Anthony DiComo, taking a look at David Wright, Wilmer Flores, and the rotation, managing Noah Syndergaard's innings and where Steven Matz fits in. Talking Phillies with Todd Zielecki and looking at how they manage some of those young player-veteran balances, as well as the emergence of Ken Giles. Talking Nationals with Bill Ladson. We'll be looking at Steven Strasburg's hot streak, the back of the rotation, and the use of Trey Turner. We have exactly two games to go on, so it is hardly fair, but it's New York, and so we don't really worry about fair or waiting till all the results are in. Nine at-bats, what have you seen from David Wright so far?
Well, he has his power back. That seems abundantly clear from the first swing he took, which he parked in the second deck at Citizens Bank Park. And you're right, you can't draw too many conclusions from nine at-bats. But there was a significant worry, especially when people saw what Wright had done in his rehab assignment in the minors. This is in Class A ball, and while he hit 321, there was no power at all. It was all singles. So I think there was definitely a little bit of concern that, you know, the power wouldn't come back. This is a guy who hasn't hit for a ton of power in his career once he got through those 06, 07, 08 years. So one swing, I think, does say a lot in terms of, because it wasn't just one normal swing. This was one pretty dramatic, pretty powerful swing. And the fact that he still has that somewhere in him, even if we only see it every once in a while, I think leads me to believe it and provides a little bit of a safety net with the thought that, you know, this guy can still be that player. Now, how often can he be that player? I don't know. The Mets don't know. He's not going to play every day at first, so that's going to limit him at the start. He's probably not going to play every day for the remainder of the season. Now, once you get into the playoffs and you have off days worked into there, I think they'll find a way to play him almost every game, if not every game. But look, this is a player who has his flaws. Obviously, there's a lot of swing and miss in his game. There always has been. There always will be. Defensively, he has not looked good so far through two games. But the lift that he provides is unlike the lift that any other player really could give the Mets. And that home run was one of the more dramatic things I've seen in a pretty dramatic season for the Mets. So I think the team will take it at this point and go from here and hope he can continue to produce for them.
Is it fair to say that the most predictive piece of data we have yet on Wright is that they have played three games since he's been back and he's been in two of them?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair to say. And that's what it's going to be at first. It's going to be two on, one off, three on, one off. They'll try and work it so that, you know, he's not missing many games against left-handed pitchers, which he crushes and has always crushed. But, you know, there's no magic formula for this. They're going to talk with David Wright daily, and by them I mean the manager, the coaching staff, the physical therapy staff, training staff, all of them. Everyone's going to have input in this. And David Wright, who has been notoriously dishonest throughout his career, and I don't mean that in a bad way because it's just the type of competitor that he is, but has been notoriously dishonest about how he's felt, when he's needed a day off, things like that, really, you know, for the first time in his life, has to be honest and has to tell them if there's even a twinge, if there's the tiniest little thing that's affecting him. Because, you know, this is a condition, again, that is not very common for baseball players. You're talking about a back problem. It could have serious future implications if he ever suffers a setback. So they're going to do everything in their power to make sure that doesn't happen. This guy's still... forget about this season for a second. This guy is still under team control through 2020 through a huge contract. The Mets need him. They need him to be more than a bench player. They need him eventually to get back to playing every day or something pretty close to it. So, yeah, it's going to be very tightly managed. I think the fact that the Mets have built up a little bit of a division lead here certainly helps that they don't feel like they have to rely on this guy. And, you know, on the same side of that coin, the fact that they have other guys who are producing at that position helps, that they don't necessarily have to rely on this guy every day. I think David Wright realizes that. I think for the first time in a long time, probably since about 08, he doesn't feel like he has to be the guy in the middle of the lineup. And I think all of that's going to help as they try and keep him healthy and sit him regularly down the stretch.
Elsewhere in the infield, it is interesting to me, and it's always interesting to me what the Mets do with a big announcement and what they do quietly, and you just notice it's happening. Wilmer Flores playing shortstop regularly again, as far as I know, is in the latter category. How did they kind of land on that, and how is he looking?
Well, when the Mets made all these trades and you know, totally revamped their offense, I remember talking on this podcast and saying I think the guy who's going to suffer in terms of playing time is Wilmer Flores. Tejada was playing pretty well at the time. Flores was, I mean, he had that, obviously, that big game where he, you know, where he cried and then a couple days later hit the walk-off homer. But, you know, by and large, he hadn't done a whole lot for the Mets. And since then, he's really caught fire. He hasn't played every day, which maybe has helped in some sense. But he's been a pretty consistent presence offensively. And again, the Mets are still operating under this system where if you hit, you're going to play. Well, Wilmer Flores has hit. He's been well over 300 since that time, since that night when he thought he was traded. He's hitting with power. He's essentially doing all the things offensively that the Mets hoped he would do in April, May, and June. And, you know, whether he had failed to do those things because he was struggling defensively, because he felt pressure, maybe just because he was still a little inexperienced, we all forget, at this level, it's hard to say. But he is producing now. And I'm not going to sit here and say this is who he is now and he's going to be this star offensively. I think the Mets still hope that for him and think it's his ceiling. And as long as he continues producing, he's going to play more often than Tejada, because I don't think anyone doubts that he has a higher offensive ceiling. But, yeah, quietly he's settled in at shortstop. I think the hitting has taken some pressure off his defense. I know that's kind of the cliche storyline, but you know, everyone says it's true with this guy. And as long as he continues doing it, he's going to continue playing, because he's just one of a number of guys who are making this offense chug on a nightly basis now.
Bill, I want to start with a topic we've touched on a lot, in part because it's a topic of great interest to me. I am consistently fascinated by Steven Strasburg. And I was kind of looking not just at the overall numbers, and I think we all know they've been excellent lately, but I think the thing that really stands out to me is that since his return from the DL, and really since his first return from the DL before he got hurt the second time, he is missing bats in a way he wasn't earlier in the year. It's something like a 13% swinging strike percentage, whereas it was like 7 or 8% over the first 2 months. In retrospect, should we have maybe wondered if Strasburg was physically compromised in some way a lot for the first 2 months? I mean, it just seems like you kind of put it all together. This is the guy we expect to see, and the guy we saw in April and May was not.
There's no question about it. He was compromised, and you know, obviously, mechanically, he wasn't right after he hurt his ankle during spring training. So, and after he came back the first time, yes, he was back to his usual self. He's striking out people, as you put it. He's missing bats. And that's a good thing. You wish he was there the whole season. If he was there the whole season, you know, maybe they would be in first place right now, but they're not.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, there's a lot going on with this club. And this club, not just Strasburg, this club overall is fascinating. But I think the thing that really jumps out about this team right now, one, they're 5-3 over their last eight games, which is you know, kind of easy to lose sight of when the Mets are playing so well. But you know, this team was built around its rotation. I mean, that's what we all talked about, the famous quote from Bryce Harper about where's my ring. You know, we all thought this was going to be a historically dominant rotation, and it was very good in the first half. They've really scuffled overall in the second half. Even Max Scherzer hasn't been great. But the guy that really stands out to me is Gio Gonzalez. He's got 35 innings total in his last seven starts, and that's a problem. They need these guys to be getting deep in games to set up a bullpen that is strong at the back end, I think, or at least should be, but maybe still has some questions in the middle. What's going on with Gonzalez that he's not getting deeper into games?
Well, first of all, you know, the last three or four starts, he simply throws too many pitches. And why that is, he's not throwing enough strikes, that's for sure. And I don't know if it's mechanical, but, you know, you can also say that maybe he doesn't have the right catcher behind him, because yesterday he had Wilson Ramos. Usually it's Jose Lobaton. So, I mean, I don't know what it is with Gio. It's hard to say with him. I have to believe it's a combination of mechanics. There's something going on mentally in his brain that's not right. I really believe that. And also, you know, he might not have the right catcher. It seems to me when Lobaton is there behind the plate, things are going right. When Wilson Ramos is there, things are always going wrong. Now, Gio Gonzalez, do not blame Wilson Ramos for yesterday's loss. But it's a coincidence that with Wilson Ramos there, Gio Gonzalez does not pitch well at all.
There's an interesting number, though, and you know, I'm a guy, I have never quite been as high on Gonzalez as some people are, so I say this not to be an apologist, but, you know, it's interesting, one of the things that stands out, you look at his recent numbers, his strikeout and walk rates over this stretch of six or seven starts are actually pretty good. He's averaging a strikeout an inning. He's walking, I think it's something like 3.5 guys per nine, which is more than a lot of people, but for Gonzalez, it's not out of line. You know, this stretch here, this six, because we were talking about him so highly month, 6 weeks ago. This stretch here, he hasn't gotten even a games, and there have been some bad results, but at the same time, some of the peripherals are good. Do you see anything in him that would sort of make those things add up? The fact that he's still striking guys out, he's not walking the whole squad, I mean, by his standards, and yet the results aren't good. How does that kind of add up to you?
To me, Matthew, it's a matter of, he's just throwing too many pitches. I mean, like, I watched his games the last three or four games, and it was funny. Gio Gonzalez asked me, Bill, what did you think of my outing? I said, Gio, you threw too many pitches. I mean, because that's why he always lasts no more than five innings. And I think the Nationals want him to go deeper than that. They want him to go at least into the seventh inning. But lately, he just can't seem to do that. I think something's in his head that's bothering him. What that is, I don't know. But, obviously yesterday when he was taken out of the game, he was clearly upset because he only pitched 4 2/3. And it looked like he wanted to stay in. And the interesting thing there was that he threw 83 pitches, and he could have gone longer. But Matt Williams didn't want to take any chances and took him out. And I totally understand because he just wastes too many pitches, just wastes too many.
Mark, we've talked a good bit, and everybody around who's interested in the Braves has talked a good bit about Shelby Miller. No, I'm certainly one of those geeks who is on the kill the win bandwagon and think that in analysis we worry too much about them, but I've also spent enough time around players to know the players care. That's something that matters. These guys, they care. They don't like not getting wins. They don't like taking losses. It's something that in the clubhouse, at least, even if they understand that it doesn't really tell you the whole story, a pitcher or starter who's not getting wins is not a happy starter. And so the reason I bring that up is, I look at Shelby Miller's recent starts, and his walks are way up recently. He's averaging basically a walk every two innings in August. And this may be a stretch, but I wonder when a guy has had the absolute absence of run support that he's gotten, do you think that those things are related? Do you think that there is some degree to which Shelby Miller is maybe getting a little too fine, that this is weighing on him, that he's starting to think, man, if I give up even one run, I'm done?
Yeah, I do. I think that it has to, you know, with every passing start, it weighs on him a little bit more. And while he can step back and certainly have every reason to be proud of what he has done, the numbers show with ERA, even his FIP, you break down anything, opponent's batting average, on base percentage, whatever you want to look at, other than wins and losses, which are much more telling of how he pitched, the other numbers being, with that being, at the end of the day, you know, the guy wants to win. He wants to have a W next to his name, and more importantly, he wants to help the team win. And I do think it has weighed on him, even last when we look back at Wednesday night's game, it felt like, you know, this was the perfect situation for him. He has a 3-0 lead heading into the seventh inning. At that point in time, he's retired 14 straight, and everything just kind of falls apart. You have to wonder if he's thinking, okay, let's just, okay, all I have to do is finish this inning, you know, maybe even get into the eighth inning. It's right there in front of you, and the pressure just gets to you a little bit more. Maybe you think a little bit more. You grip the ball a little bit tighter. Did he have some bad luck in that inning? Maybe. I mean, there was a double that bounced in front of Michael Bourne. There was a chopper off the plate. But at the same time, you know, the Rockies were centering the ball a lot more during that inning. And like you said, we even go back one start earlier to the Cubs. You know, that wasn't the same Shelby Miller we've seen day in and day out. And you're not going to see that every start. But at the same time, I do think, you know, once you start getting there where you're saying, okay, well, this is the chance I'm going to be able to end this maddening streak, you know, I think it does weigh on you a little bit more. Even if he had gotten through that seventh inning clean against the Rockies the other night, and let's say they handed over to the bullpen, he knows, he's watched that bullpen throughout the year. He knows that's it's out of his hands at that point in time. So all that probably does weigh on him.
And that actually, you tee me up perfectly. What a pro. Leads into something else I've been wanting to ask about. And unfortunately, it's not really a question with a solution, but I just wonder, to what extent is it a worry when a team is – because, look, we talk about, yeah, you know, a non-contending team, what in the world do they need a closer for? This is a team that's trying to develop young starters. I mean, the everyday lineup isn't really that young right now. The guys are coming, but they're not really trying to develop an offensive core right now. They're trying to develop the core of a starting rotation right now. Even Miller. I mean, Miller is still a young, developing pitcher. To what extent is there worry on the part of the front office, on the part of the manager, about what it does to the starters and to their confidence and to their development when they know that except for the guy in the ninth, they kind of have to worry about what happens when they come out of the game?
Yeah, no, I think it does weigh on the front office's mind a little bit. I do know that they have they've reached out to Tom Glavine and John Smoltz, and they want to bring him in not only to talk to the guys about pitching, but talk to them about that developmental stage. Let's remember that Glavine and Smoltz went through, Smoltz the last few months of 88, but Glavine throughout 1988, and 1989, 1990, those were, you know, some similar situations to where, you know, they were on teams where, you know, it didn't necessarily matter what you did with the pitch once it left your hand. They had a subpar defense behind them, a bullpen that wasn't dependable, and an offense that was similar to what we've seen here with the Braves this year. And I think they want to just get into these pitchers' minds. Hey, look, you know, you go out here, you do your thing. At the same time, you know, they want to get them into that mindset where if you have to win a game 1-0, you know, you got to do everything in your power to win it. But at the same time, they don't want them to be worn down by the losses. And I don't really see it with the guys right now. You know, the two guys. The one guy that I'm really most intrigued with is Mike Fulton. He's just based on his stuff. And Whistler is, he seems to be pretty headstrong. And the progress that I've seen from Mike Fulton in spring training, I saw a guy who allowed him, he was pitching, I think it was a 2 or 3 inning effort against the Phillies. And he went through the first inning pretty impressive, gets 2 outs in the second inning, gives up back-to-back homers, and then he just fell apart. I haven't seen that guy the last 2 or 3 outings. The numbers have not been pretty. I understand that. But, you know, I do see progress in, you know, with his stuff in terms of fastball command, and his slider has become a little bit more consistent. He's also adding a splitter. With Whistler, I have not seen that top of the rotation type of stuff yet. Although, you know, he's still so young in his development, you know, you want to be patient, see if his slider can can become more effective on a consistent basis. And then, like you said, you've got Williams Perez in that rotation. That's three rookies. So it's, you know, not only are they cognizant of, they're worried about where these guys are, you know, how they might be affected mentally by these losses, but at the same time, they're going to have to take care of them here in September a little bit too, just because, you know, they're going to, these guys are going to be start throwing more innings than they have previously in their career. Williams Perez will have a little bit of a benefit because he spent a month on the disabled list, but they're going to have to take care of these guys a little bit in September, just in terms of workload as well.
Joe, the seemingly biggest story surrounding the Marlins the past couple of days has nothing to do with the roster and has to do with the ballpark. Let's talk a little bit about the fences. What's the thought process as they apparently are serious about moving them in and or making them shorter?
Yeah, in year four, they for the first time, the organization is kind of willing to budge on what is, you know, arguably the most difficult ballpark in baseball to hit a home run. Not only are the dimensions quite large, the ball just doesn't carry, you know, very well in South Florida and in that ballpark particularly. And David Sampson, team president, is open to, you know, moving them in. Now, the All-Star Game's coming in a couple of years in 17, and the Home Run Derby, of course, is a huge showcase. And, you know, I think they'd like the park to play a little more fairly by the time that happens. And they're considering it. You know, I know David's been talking to a lot of the offensive players who are, you know, making their case. And, you know, some of the numbers kind of speak, you know, for themselves. You know, they're, you know, among the last place in home runs in their own ballpark. That park itself is. And since the park opened up in 2012, not only have home runs been low, but doubles have been low. And, you know, the feeling was with the big gaps that there'd be a lot of, you know, doubles, if not homers. But what you're kind of seeing what defenses are doing is they're basically regular depth. There's kind of no doubles in most parks, and teams will give up the flares and the bloops to run balls down the gaps. Obviously, if you hit anything really well, you'll get, you know, rewarded. But the middle of this field, there's more outs that are in the 410 to 420 range than I've ever seen in any ballpark. And even the old ballpark, which when the Marlins played at Sun Life, which went out to 434, the ball just carried differently there. And, you know, here things are getting run down that have a lot of hitters very flabbergasted.
I guess what I wonder is what has changed. I mean, we sort of know the city's at sea level, so that's sort of step one. That means that even with the heat and humidity, the ball's not going to travel like it does some places. That's just sort of basic physics. Even a neutrally sized park will probably play tough to hit in. This is a big park with big fences. What has happened now that makes this something they want to do when maybe it wasn't something they wanted to do when it opened or over the previous couple of years?
Well, I think in general, Matthew, they're looking at to give it three or four years, just to, you know, just to kind of let it play its course. You know, obviously some other ballparks, City Field, Safeco, Petco, have all had faces, you know, fences come in recent years. And, you know, obviously the signing of Giancarlo. You know, when Stanton signed, it was, you know, it came up in the discussions. No one's getting too much into specifics if any specific promises were made, but, you know, it wasn't written into the contract that the fences would come in. But you have, you know, one of the, if not the premier home run guy in the game in terms of, you know, putting on a power display and, you know, try to make him, you know, not be as punished as some other hitters. And also, you know, they're seeing the fact that, you know, you got Ozuna and Yelich, you know, who two regular outfielders and Stanton, they came into the year thinking this was as good an outfield as there is in the game and certainly the National League. And Ozuna and Yelich have a combined two home runs at Marlins Park, one apiece. And, you know, even with Ozuna spending more than a month in AAA, that's still a staggeringly low number for a guy who had 23 last year. Plus, outside of Stanton, I think Stanton has like 60 home runs or something like that in Marlins Park since it opened. The next highest of any player is 13 by Ozuna. It's just, you know, the ballpark, you know, the offensive players, you know, this year, as frustrating as it's been for everybody involved, I've seen more players, helmet throws, you know, hands go up in disgust, hitting the ball seemingly out of reach and it being run down at 4-15 range. So I think a combination of that, that the players are kind of making an argument that they're almost having two approaches, a road approach and a home approach. And by the time they kind of adjust to the road, they're coming back home. You know, there's all sorts of stuff that I'm hearing in private conversations with these guys that that show that they don't feel they're being rewarded in the middle of the field, which most hitters are kind of, you know, raised and trained to do effectively. Obviously, if you pull the ball, you have a better chance of getting it out. And, you know, those aren't always the most ideal swings if the pitch isn't geared for that. So I just think it's kind of time. On top of that, you also noted the height of the fences. They go 11 and a half feet to 13. And, you know, just simply lowering them a couple of feet not only would bring the exciting play of the potential robbed home run into Marlins Park, but, you know, guys would also be, you know, rewarded a little bit more if, you know, they do hit it a pretty good distance.
Todd, it's actually a pretty intriguing time to be following the Phillies as a lot of these guys, they got a lot of guys who are pretty close to the big leagues in this assortment of trades they made, including most notably some starting pitchers. From the guys you've already seen, from Jared Eichhoff, what have you seen from him in an admittedly small number of innings so far?
Well, you know, he's a big guy with a big arm, a lot of talent, and they like him because he's aggressive and he doesn't seem to get rattled too much. I think we saw a little bit of that last night against the Mets where he struggled early, then kind of came on and I think it was, 16 straight batters retired at that point. And this is a Mets team that is pretty much consistently pounded on the Phillies all week here at Citizens Bank Park. So the fact that a kid like that kind of collected himself, went back out there and finished strong, I think got them excited a little bit, you know, because obviously didn't want the alternative, which was he gets beat around. The next thing you know, he's knocked out after three innings, and you're going to the bullpen. So encouraging, yeah, like you said, small sample size, but encouraging at least that he's kind of handled himself well in his first two starts.
It stands out just this is one of my habits on this podcast is warning against scouting the stats and then scouting the stats. But with that said, he really seems to have cut his walks this year. Now, I know you obviously weren't following this guy closely before the last few weeks, but have you heard anything about that from people around the club? This year his walk rate was down in AAA compared to AA, and he has thrown strikes at the big league level. And if you're a big guy with a big arm and you can throw strikes, that's a pretty good start.
It is. You know, nothing specifically about why the walks have gone down, other than they just think he's kind of gaining more experience along the way. So maybe that has something to do with it, just kind of a guy getting maybe a little bit more comfortable with himself out there on the mound. And as that confidence grows, as you go up through the system, you know, you like to see guys that understand the purpose of getting that first pitch strike and how everything kind of feeds off of that. And that's something that the Phillies, not necessarily Eichhoff, obviously, because he hasn't been here that long, but that's something they're trying to preach to these pitchers early on, you know, keep the ball down low in the strike zone, but attack the strike zone, get yourself set up, get yourself into some pitcher counts. And it sounds something easy to do, but I think a lot of times these pitchers, they might try to pitch away from contact a little bit, and then you start nibbling, and then you start walking guys, and then you start thinking too much, and then it starts to snowball on you. But so far so good with Eichhoff on that count.
Broadly, what do they do with the rotation over these final five plus weeks of the season? You've written some about this. They've got a bunch of kids they want to take a look at, and look, it's easy to say toss aside Aaron Harang and or Jerome Williams, but these guys have been good soldiers. They've done their work and been a part of the club all year, and it's not as easy. It's not as easy as it may seem to just tell these guys, well, yep, sorry, you're out of luck. How do they kind of manage those various elements in putting together a rotation over the final weeks?
Yeah, it is interesting. They, you know, they've talked about possibly, not necessarily publicly too much, but they've talked internally, I think, a little bit about Alec Asher, who's another one of the guys that got Nicole Hamill's deal. And maybe he should be called up in September and get a look. And if that happens, either they said they discussed a six-man rotation or, you know, keeping the five-man rotation, which means somebody like Jerome Williams might get bumped out. Now, six-man rotation actually kind of makes sense because they want to watch the innings of Nola, Eichhoff. If Asher comes up, they want to watch his innings. And Adam Morgan is coming off a shoulder injury, so they want to kind of be very careful with these guys. So in that sense, a six-man rotation does make sense. And I think the other thing the Phillies are considering or just keeping in mind is we want to bring these guys up when we're ready. I've heard a lot of fans this season say, just bring them up, just throw them in the water and see if they can swim. And in my opinion, that's not really the way to go about it. You know, you want to try to bring these kids up when you feel they're ready to be brought up and they're ready to succeed. Or let me put it this way, if they come up and they struggle, they're ready to handle those struggles. You know, you don't want to call up a guy here who's maybe pitching well in Double-A, call him up here, have his brains get beat in, have his confidence get shot, and then you have to build him back up next season. You would like to bring him up when he's ready and then just kind of let him go. So, you know, as I look at it right now, I think Asher might have the best chance of getting called up with any of those prospects. And if they do, it wouldn't surprise me if they do a six-man rotation.
MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.